listen, think, learn, grow. Listen, think, learn, grow. Live.
This is the Spirit of Life Metaphysics Radio Program, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Michael Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening and welcome to the Spirit of Life program for Wednesday, June 25th. My name is Michael Kelly. I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Well, good evening, Michael. As always, I'm very glad to be here, and we have a special guest.
We do. Very excited about that. Also very excited to see everybody that we usually see in our live chat. We appreciate your contributions. We appreciate you being here. And as always, we appreciate the people that take the time to catch up with us from the archives. Spirit of Life is a weekly service and educational program of the International Church of Metaphysical Humanism. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as to explore science and spirituality. In addition to this broadcast, ICMH offers other educational programs that can be found at metaphysicsinstitute.org and tfuniversity.org. As always, we're going to begin tonight with our 9 abbreviated principles of belief. Those are 1. Do no harm, do right. 2. We believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3. We believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems. 4. We are all equal. One ancestry, one destiny. 5. We recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6. We are physical and spiritual beings. Consciousness survives death of the physical body. 7. Self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will create self-completeness. 8. Metaphysical education and practical life skills empower the human spirit and enhance the human condition. And 9. Expanding human consciousness leads to evolution and peaceful coexistence. Very excited for tonight's guest, but real quick, a bit of housekeeping. Next week, we are going to be joined by Dr. Doug Kelly. He has a topic of artificial intelligence and academic integrity. So I hope you all join us for that. But for tonight, can't wait to get into it. Welcome, Dr. Mike Tickner. Did I lose you?
Oh, no. Hello there.
Welcome, Dr. Mike.
I'm glad to be here after last week.
Well,
completely understandable.
And we're glad you're feeling a little better, so, and you could be
here with
us.
Yeah, well, today was the first day I actually was able to taste coffee, so that's a big improvement.
Oh, that is a huge improvement.
I'll say. So just for those who are new to Dr. Mike, he's our resident scientist, oceanographer, shark specialist, as well as associated with MUFON and UFO research, and he's got quite the background. We're so glad he's here. And before the program, Dr. Mike, you were telling us that you have a special trip coming up here right away in Waco, Texas.
Oh, yeah. I was contacted by the Bottom Time Dive Club in Waco. There's about 50 members or so. And however they got my name, I'm not real sure. But anyway, they asked me if I'd come down and do a presentation on sharks. And I said, okay.
And you're putting a whole big visual together for them? And,
yeah, I've got a slideshow that consists of about, 15 or 20 slides. And it's all about... basically, a lot of information about sharks, like the top 5 of this, the top 5 of that, and so forth like that. Just information that, people basically don't know. Or, I mean, not everybody. Some people will know. But so anyway, as a starting point, I thought if... I could just kind of go through some of them.
I'd like to know
answer questions.
I kind of like to know what it is that they'd be interested in and what you're presenting to them. So,
well,
absolutely.
Basically, I give them a little background about the Shark Research Institute, some of the people that I've worked with, and so forth like that. And, you know, that sort of stuff. I don't know if anybody's heard of some of the people that I work with on this. One of them, her name is Marie Levine. She actually started the Shark Research Institute many years ago. And unfortunately, she passed away earlier this year. And the other person who actually helped start it and passed away is Stan Waterman. And he's well known worldwide. He's kind of like right there next to Jacques Cousteau. And so forth. You know, people like Sylvia Earle. Have you ever heard of her?
No, not I haven't.
Okay. She's really, you know, well known as well. And what's interesting about Sylvia Earle is that you'd think that she would be an oceanographer or something like that. She's actually a botanist. And anyway, so, you know, people like that. And, you know, just kind of an introduction to that. What happened to SRI now that the couple main people are no longer with us? It's kind of being absorbed by another group called SeaSave. And I'm not really sure where it's going to go from there. I do know the main lady that's running SeaSave, and she's very capable. So I, you know, hope good things will come of that. Things like, trying to think here.
I think he's going through his notes.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right here. I got a.
It's
kind of one of those things where I I'm trying to blow it up so I can actually read it. but you know, I go through a little taxonomy and so forth of the shark. And here's a little fact. Everybody guess. Just take a guess. How many different species of sharks are worldwide? Anybody want to just guess?
Oh, wow.
A couple of dozen?
Oh, no more than that, I imagine. And I know there's a little bit of a lag in chat, so yep, Howard's putting in 2,000. I'd say in the thousands easy.
Well, not quite. 530.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And that's, you know, I mean, that changes on an everyday basis. And it's kind of one of those things where, believe it or not, sharks range from the tiny dwarf lantern shark, which is about 8 inches long, full grown, to the whale shark, which is the largest one ever recorded, was 60 feet. And so forth. I go through the common orders of sharks. There's like eight different orders of sharks that they fall into. The longest living sharks are whale sharks.
I would have thought that, yeah.
Yeah. And, basking sharks.
I feel like that name is self-descriptive.
Yeah, they're pretty big. They get up to about 39 feet.
Ooh.
Great whites are 20 to 23 feet.
Oh, wow. Bigger than great whites.
Yeah, there's only been a couple of them that they found at 20-foot level. One of them was up around the, not the Galapagos Islands, but off of Mexico at the... oh, hell, I forgot the name of the island out there. Anyway, it was estimated to be 20 feet, and its name is Big Blue.
Oh, that makes sense.
Tiger sharks, about 16 feet is maximum on those.
Wow.
And the fifth largest one is the Greenland shark, which is around, actually, it's a little bigger. It gets up to 23 feet.
Wow.
So, they're big.
Yeah. Here's an interesting thing. Everybody talks about the megalodon, right?
Yep.
The megalodon was estimated to be around 60 to 70 feet.
Massive.
Yeah, and it weighs around 50 to 70 tons.
Mm.
And fortunately for everybody, 2 to 3 million years ago is when it extinct. Now, I have actually found some megalodon teeth. Mine are very small. Mine are like 3 or 4 inches. The largest megalodon tooth recovered so far is 7 inches.
How do they know it's a megalodon? Do they do DNA testing on it?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, they that's a good question.
No, I'm megalodons. Sure
they just, I mean, who else is going to have a tooth that's 7 inches?
Yeah.
And I'm thinking the whale shark, is that bigger than the megalodon?
It's about the largest whale shark was recorded at around 60 feet.
But they don't have the teeth.
They don't have teeth. They have what's called radula. It's kind of like sandpaper type stuff.
Mm.
But, they're you know, big filter feeders is what they are. But the megalodon is quite different. I got another slide that mentions megalodon that's kind of interesting. Here's a few answers. Things. Any idea what do you think the fastest sharks are?
That's a good question. Oh,
Jaws.
I was gonna say tiger sharks, but that's just random.
No, tiger sharks don't even make the list of top five. The fastest shark is a short fin mako.
Okay.
And it has a top speed of 46 miles an hour.
That's a good speed.
Yeah, it is. Salmon shark, which I'm not that familiar with, is comes in next. The great white is 25 to 35 miles an hour.
That's fast enough.
Now, you got to keep in mind, a great white that's, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 pounds can shoot itself completely out of the water and breach. So
I didn't know they could breach like that.
Oh, they completely out of the water. Mm. And that's what they do with their prey, like a seal or whatever is on the surface. They'll way down deep and they'll come straight up and they'll hit whatever it is at their full speed of 25 to 35 miles an hour, and it'll launch them completely out of the water.
Oh, wow. That actually, you know, that leads into my next question. I recall the orcas do similar things, although I think they use their tails to pop seals up in the air.
Yeah,
but
they kind of play tennis.
I remember orcas actually hunt them. Great whites.
Yeah, but yeah, they're great whites are really kind of amazing when you see them. They're scary too looking.
Oh yeah.
But so after great white comes, you're familiar with the blue shark. It's pretty well a Pacific Coast type shark, but it goes in at 24 to 25 miles an hour. A thresher shark, which to me I think they're kind of neat because they're the ones that have this huge, huge long tail. And what they do is they use it like a whip, and they'll go through a school of fish, and they whip this tail back and forth. And it stuns the prey and they eat it. So
is that, is that the one that kind of has that two little fins on the end? If I'm trying to remember what
the
that
blue
looks
shark?
Like. The
The
one
thresher
with the
shark?
long, yeah, with the long tail.
Yeah, it's a very, very long petrel fin. Yeah, I don't know if it has two, but...
Well, I'm looking at it now. It does have a very long, what is it, ventral fin, did you say? The one that's at the very end?
Yeah, I was just thinking, is that the one with the two little fins at the end, or prongs kind of thing? No?
I'm not real sure.
Maybe I'm thinking of a different fish.
Well, when I looked it up, I can see the end tail that they use for swimming. I don't know the term for it. I want to say ventral or something. But,
yeah, there's dorsal, ventral, and so forth.
Yeah.
Okay. Right, right. It's a very long top end on that, and I think that's what you're referring to whipping around, right?
Yeah, its tail fin is extremely tall, and, you know, and that's what they use to stun the prey. Now, to give you a little perspective here, any idea what the fastest fish is?
Oh, that's a good question. I got to say maybe something a little smaller, but I have no idea.
Yeah, actually, they're pretty good size.
Barracuda?
No, black marlin.
Mm, really?
Okay.
50 to 80 miles an hour.
Ooh.
Well, I imagine they'd have to be fast to get away from some of these sharks.
Yeah, well, you're not going to swim faster than that. That's for damn sure.
No, we're not. Listening to these shark top speeds brings me back to that phrase, you don't have to be faster than the shark, just faster than the person
behind
you. Yeah,
faster than the person behind you. That's all you got to do. I mentioned earlier about most aggressive sharks, the five most aggressive sharks. And this to me, is, I'll have to say, the order I question a little bit, but they have the great white is the most aggressive, and number two is the bull shark.
Oh, now Kevin was asking about that earlier in the chat because he lives on the Connecticut River, wondering if there are bull sharks there.
Absolutely.
And it leads out to the ocean, so
Well, bull sharks have been found 1,000 miles up the Mississippi and 2,000 miles up the Amazon.
Ooh.
After bull shark is a tiger shark.
Mm-hmm. Well, that makes sense.
Tiger sharks are known as garbage sharks.
Right.
They have actually found license plates, small tires, and all sorts of weird stuff in sharks after they dissect them. So they pretty well eat anything.
How does it not kill them?
What?
Like a license plate.
Like a license plate going through the digestive system.
It just hangs there. I mean, eventually metal will dissolve. I don't know about small tires. I have no idea.
And they are very large, so I assume their digestive system's large enough to accommodate some of these things. But also brings to mind ocean dumping. You should probably stop that.
Well... It's still a problem.
Oh, yeah, it is.
But after the tiger shark is the oceanic white tip. And back in World War II, I think it was the USS Missouri or Mississippi or one of those, I can't remember, it was torpedoed.
You thinking about the one where they were all in the water getting picked off?
Yeah.
Indianapolis.
Is it Indianapolis? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a total of 1,400 in the water. And by the time they rescued them, there was only like 400 left. And the primary shark was the oceanic whitetip. The fifth most aggressive is the short fin mako.
Fastest, right? So,
yeah.
You know, listening to all these apex predators, I'm thinking, and again, I think I touched on it earlier. I know of one species that hunts sharks. Is it more than just the orca that hunt shark? Do they hunt each other?
As far as I know, the only one that I know that actually will hunt and take on a white shark is an orca. That's the only one that I know of. Now, the ocean's a big place. And they've only, covered 10, less than 10% of it.
Right.
So what else is out there? There's always this thing, well, maybe the megalodon still exists. Well, I mean, I'm not going to say it doesn't, but I kind of doubt it. But, I mean, the coelacanth, for example, was thought to be extinct for millions of years, and they found it.
Yeah, I remember that. And then I guess it just has to be, what would the megalodon eat? But then again, when we don't know, we don't know.
I mean, it'd have to be pretty damn big.
Oh, yeah. But it comes back to that idea that on our very own planet, we have an alien world under the ocean.
Oh, absolutely.
Where we have so little mapped and so little knowledge.
Yeah, and to me, the most alien of all the ocean creatures is the octopus.
Oh, magical.
The longest living sharks is the Greenland shark, a lifespan of 250 to 500 years.
My God.
Whoa.
Longer than a lot of nation states.
Uh-huh. The spiny dogfish is next. It's up to 100 plus years. There's one called the Pacific sleeper. The great white shark is about 70 years. I'm not sure why the basking shark made it in there at 50 years, but the whale shark, to me, I think from what I've found, it is around 70 or 80 years.
Wow.
So I'm not sure why it didn't make that top five list, but I didn't put it together.
Somewhat related, although a little different. It blew my mind when I learned this stat a few years back that sharks have existed on this planet longer than trees have been on this planet, by maybe a couple hundred million years. And that just blew my mind, the fact that sharks, this, ideal predator for the ocean, has been around so long in one form or another. Predates a lot of life on this planet.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at that. I mean, another critter that's been around for 100 million years is the alligator. But to give you an idea of, like, bite force, for example, the great white basically has a bite force of about 4,000 PSI.
Yikes.
Now, that's enough to, pretty well crunch through most bones and so forth. The bull shark is at 1,300 PSI.
The bull shark is the one you said you'd never go in the water with.
I wouldn't go in the water. I don't trust them. Yeah.
Because they're unpredictable?
They're unpredictable and very erratic. Yeah.
Right. Highly aggressive. And they show up in fresh water where humans will swim and, fish and things like that, too, from what I hear.
Yeah. I mean, swimming in the ocean, you got to have a little common sense here. There's certain times of the day and certain water conditions you don't go into the ocean. I mean, you have to realize that's their domain, not yours.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
But a tiger shark has about 1,000 to 1,300 PSI. And the mako shark, which I mentioned earlier, is about 700 PSI. But here's, now, taking all that into consideration, the megalodon is estimated to have a bite force of around 40,000 PSI.
Oh, my good God.
Jeez.
So that kind of gives you an idea just how big that guy was.
Crunch an oil tank.
Yeah, oh, yeah. No,
yeah,
no doubt.
No wonder they made a movie about it. Now, tell me, you said that the megalodon died out 2 to 3 million years ago, if I recollect. Do we know how long they'd been around? Did they come after the, Jurassic period or the...
I'd actually have to look that up. But, they were around for, a long, long time.
Right. Wow. It is... fascinating, the types of life that we have on this planet, and the fact that you go back a few million years, you go back further, you see different continent shapes, you see different life forms on this planet, it's in a different part of the galaxy. Time and space are so intertwined that you go back far enough, it's like looking at an entirely different world that we just happen to share. Mm. And don't forget, we still want to get into some ideas about UFOs and ufology and things like that a little bit later too, but this has been a great, fascinating discussion. I love marine biology.
So the last slide,
I'll go for it real quick, kind of gives you the, it's basically the 10 most endangered sharks.
Okay.
And all of them are endangered because of habitat loss, overfishing, and probably the biggest thing is shark finning.
Yeah.
And there are certain countries that are notorious for that. One of the reasons I would never go to Costa Rica is because they're one of them.
Yeah.
But, it's really 90% of the world population of sharks have been decimated over the last 20, 30 years.
Oh, criminal.
And if I recall, I think that after Jaws came out, there was such a public panic that a lot of people really hurt that figure too. They would hunt sharks just out of fear. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, many, many years later, the creator of Jaws came out, Peter Benchley came out and said he regret making the movie because of the terrible effect it had on sharks.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. And speaking on that point, too, of tragedies with shark, Dr. Kevin asked in the chat, can you define shark finning for those that don't know?
Yeah, it's real simple. What they do is they'll catch a shark. They cut its fins off and throw it back in the water so it'll drown.
That's brutal.
And the thing about it is, you know, it's all this this nonsense about shark fins being medicinal or the... It's cartilage. It has no medicinal value at all. And as a matter of fact, sharks are one of the fish that contain the highest levels of mercury. It's because of their large liver. But that means that the cartilage is loaded with mercury.
Yeah,
so,
that's not good.
You know,
even if they did have medicinal qualities, you know, at what point do you draw the line in saying, this is too cruel, it's too inhumane, it's depleting the population of sharks? Even if it did have medicinal qualities, it gets to a point where it's not worth it.
Well, the thing about it is they could synthesize cartilage.
Oh, yeah.
It's a cultural thing, okay? And
as I recall, 20, 30 years ago, shark cartilage was a big thing on if you want to repair your bones, good for arthritis, osteoporosis.
Cancer,
all
too.
Nonsense. But
my grandmother would take these pills that supposedly had shark cartilage in them when she had bladder cancer.
Useless.
And back on the endangered sharks, Oceanic white tip is eighth on the list. Sand tiger sharks, which are very common on the East Coast, are six. Great hammerheads are five.
Oh, no.
Whale sharks are four. Great white are two. Oof. And the most endangered shark is the thresher shark.
Is that because of their large fins? They're hunted for that?
I'm not...
Or habitat loss?
I think it's habitat loss.
I see.
And I'm not really sure how much the increase in ocean temperatures globally has affected anything. I think that's going to affect your coral more than it is a lot of your fish. But overpopulation or overfeeding, you know, your catch. That didn't come out right. Anyway, I was going to say, one of the problems is overfeeding or overfishing, and they take away the source of a lot of these sharks' livelihood.
Yeah. Mm. Everything's connected.
Yeah, it is.
How do you feel about salmon farming?
I'm totally against it.
Are you?
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
The salmon that they raise in these, quote, farms that actually escape are fattier.
Mm.
The genetics makeup of them are inferior to the wild caught.
Okay.
Mm.
So what happens is if they get out, they go out there and interbreed with the normal population, resulting in a poor quality of fish.
Mm. Mm. I see.
Yeah.
So
it kind of makes me think of
if you buy salmon, you can I would totally encourage you not to get farm raised. But
sense.
I mean, there are still wild caught salmon, and I'm hoping that they manage the population so that it's, you know, not decimated.
Yeah,
but
it's tough to do, especially internationally. And then that brings me to another thought, and I do want to get to some ufology things later too, but when it comes to sustainability with fishing and salmon and all these different things, do you have any thoughts on what the right thing to do? Is it just lowering consumption, or are there any ethical and well-done fish farms?
First thing I would do is I'd get rid of the subsidies to the fishing industry, get rid of all these floating cities that go out and just totally devastate the fish populations. I mean, you're talking city blocks that just suck up everything. If they'd get rid of those and get back to your, quote, local fishermen and, you know, things like that, it would give the fish population the ability to rebound.
Mm.
I mean, like, you know, the tuna industry.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, if they go out, if they get a 50 or 60-pound tuna, they think they've hit the jackpot. But if you look at film from 40 years ago, let's say, of tuna fishermen, they were hauling in 200 and 300 pounders.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that it's just like everything. It takes a long time to repopulate.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you take a whale shark. It's not mature sexually until it's about 25 or so years old.
Wow.
And then at that point, the female, you know, maybe, you know, they really don't know how many because they're not mm-hmm. that familiar with their overall birth process and that sort of stuff like that. But, I mean, you know, you can't just go out and take all you want.
Yeah.
And the unfortunate thing, if they did that, yeah, fish would probably go to $20 or $30 a pound. Well,
right.
Okay, so be it.
Maybe it needs to be that way. No more red lobster, but, you know, the oceans can replenish.
Yeah. The
I do know that halibut here is very expensive.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Massive.
And,
yep.
You know, that's... Well, you know, halibut, one of my favorite things is abalone.
Mm. Yep.
Mm, yeah.
I used to, you know, cook it all the time when I was in San Diego. And it basically, abalone is nothing more than a ocean snail.
Mm.
And at one time, I remember back in the late 50s and early 60s, I would drive my parents up and down from San Diego to Newport Beach and so forth like that. And you'd see just mounds and mounds of abalone shells.
Mm-hmm.
And now you cannot hardly find any at all.
Wow.
As a matter of fact, up north, I think. I can't remember the exact borderline, but you cannot dive for abalone unless you're on scuba because it's very deep where they are, and they're not near as big as they used to be. And it's really it's really a shame to see where it used to be to where it is now.
Yeah. It seems to be such a common thing these days. You know, if we look at the ecology and, you know, we need to give the oceans a break, and everything is interconnected. So, you know, the ocean ecosystems tie into everything else, and it will affect us in a very big way.
Yeah, but
But
fundamentally, people don't care, honestly.
until it affects them.
Well, and
Well,
yeah,
not, I think it just goes away from the, you know, the shopping center, and oh well, they get something else.
yeah.
Well,
Well,
it.
and actual fishermen, you know, they don't see, you know, the size and the quantity of fish that were caught 100 years ago, so they don't know in, you know, on an instinctive level that it's different. You know, it's that kind of thing where it gradually happens over time. I remember reading a Time article about that and how you could go to pictures taken at popular fishing spots, you know, 75 years ago, 50 years ago, et cetera, and you can see the decline in size and quantity.
Oh yeah. One of my favorite places I used to dive was Cozumel. And 20 or 30 years ago, the reef system was just loaded with all sorts of aquatic life. And nowadays it's very sparse.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's pretty well affected a lot of different places.
Before we
Texas.
lose this in the chat, Howard is just asking, can you talk about the nasty conditions of farmed salmon and what they're feeding them?
You know, I really don't know what they feed them.
Okay.
All I know is that the end result is a very poor quality salmon.
Okay. Fair enough.
And
I didn't want to lose that in the chat, that's all.
yeah, no, I have no idea.
Okay. You know, it's kind of like this. My philosophy is I eat a minimal amount of red meat, but I only buy from local farmers. And the place I ordinarily buy my meat from here, thankfully we have it, is I go in and I can buy ground beef, but it's all from one cow. Because people don't know that when you buy ground, it's from 50 different cows. You know, it's whatever they have left over, they throw it all into one and grind it up. And
There's a just remind me of a funny series of books, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
yes, I've
Now,
yeah. Classic.
in the movie is, you know, it's fair, but the books, and what's kind of interesting is the author called it a trilogy. However, there were five books. So it kind
That
of shows
sounds
you
about
where he
right.
comes from. But in one of the books at the end, they're in a restaurant, and the cow comes out to the table and starts describing all the different cuts that you can enjoy and everything like that. And I'm just, you know, I read that, I'm going, well, that's pretty damn bizarre. But yeah, I mean, the cow came out and sold itself and said, what, you know, it was, but yeah, you're right. Nowadays, you don't get just a single cow. I mean, it's all. And
Well, it's
the other thing
industrialized.
that I've always said is if people actually went through a slaughterhouse, they would never
Yep.
eat meat again.
Yeah. And that's why support local, whatever you can do. If you know folks, so you get a marketplace that ships in from the farm, even 100 miles away, that's better than, you know, the big, oh, yeah, it's
Yeah,
not,
factory farming.
Well,
yeah.
I mean,
You know,
it's to me, it's kind of out of portion. I don't eat that much red meat anymore.
yeah, I don't either,
And
but.
I don't eat a lot of fish. I do eat some, and when I get salmon, I'll make sure that it's not farm raised.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, there's so much pollution that fish are loaded with mercury.
Yes, they are.
Especially shrimp. People don't realize that. But shrimp and oysters and things like that contain a high degree of mercury.
Do you remember, Dr. Mike, when we were kids, you cut your finger and our parents would put on mucuricome?
Oh, yeah.
Never heard of that one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
It's a red, thin red liquid.
It's basically
on a
like
a little glass dauber. Yeah, and, you know, just so much for a little mercury and iodine.
I wonder if I'm sure they still sell it.
Well,
I don't know.
I'll just say this real quick. You know, I am not a vegetarian at all, but factory farming, that's tough. I know we have a growing population, but yeah, I agree with you. If you can do local, if you can do, you know, grass fed, you know, animals that can at least live the life they were supposed to live, you know, that's how I view it. But, this has been a, go ahead.
I just want to say, I know it's not feasible for a lot of people, especially when you live in cities, but you can do your best. You can source them out. So,
absolutely.
Well,
and, you know, we're running short on time, and I do want to try and catch in some ufology, because I know we have a couple of questions, and you're a voice on that. And we've talked about this a lot in the past, just segueing from the oceans to ufology. I know one of the popular ideas, and I think we've talked about it, the idea that that some possible UFOs, be they alien or whatever, anything that's, you know, terrestrial, that they have bases, let's call them, in the ocean. And what are your thoughts on that?
You think about the ocean, what a perfect place to hide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, when only less than, I think it's more like less than 7% or something like that, has been studied. I mean, that's, and then considering over 70% of the Earth is water.
Yeah.
Exactly. To me, it would be a, you know, if I was a, you know, alien species coming in and say, you know, where we want to park, I would say right there in the ocean somewhere. But yeah, I think it, there's a lot that goes into actually USOs, and they're also called fast movers.
Now, USO stands for?
Underwater submersible.
Gotcha. Okay.
And you know, there's many, many cases of UAPs, UFOs, whatever you want to call them, entering and exiting water.
Mm.
So yeah, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you kind of have to wonder. You know, first of all, I've never seen one, so I'm assuming that based on a lot of observation and a lot of stuff I've read and so forth, like they exist. They've seen them. They've taken pictures of them. So I have to believe that they exist.
Well, that lends to a question Howard asked way early on in the chat. How many species are you aware of or been told about that live actually within the Earth itself that are not extraterrestrial?
Somewhere, and I'm trying to think back on this, I may have a document somewhere. I'd have to look. But it seems like there's a couple dozen different,
you know, it's a quotes. And that kind of brings back to the other question. I think from Dr. Kevin, correct me if I'm wrong. He had also talked about, you know, what do we think about you know, UFOs from prior civilizations, and that brought to my mind, you know, these myths about Atlantean culture, and did they die out or did they go somewhere else? And, you know, you just touched on these terrestrial things. Do we have terrestrial and extraterrestrial? So many, you know, questions to speculate on.
Yeah, there's, you speculate all day long, a lot of that. I have a keen interest in the Anunnaki.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've read the, you know, Gilgamesh, and I've done all that sort of stuff like that. And I find it very interesting that one thing, they have traced the human DNA back to about 250,000 years ago, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if you're familiar with the Anunnaki, that's about the time, according to all the writings and so forth like that, that's about the time that they came to Earth and just started their, genetic manipulation, whatever you want to call it, of the human species. And, to me, that's kind of a coincidence. Now, did that really happen? I have no idea.
Well, right. I mean, how can we know at this point? It's speculation, but still interesting things to consider.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of things. I think, number one, I think archaeology has done a lot, but I think archaeology in itself is a big guess.
It is.
And they base it on things that, to me, doesn't really make sense. But, a fact, the pyramids of Giza are lined up to Orion's belt. That's a pretty well-known thing. Except nowadays, it doesn't exactly line up with that. So what they've done is they put that in reverse and went back, and they found that about 10,000 years ago, it actually lined up.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So my question is, why do they keep saying the pyramids are only 4,000 years old?
Yeah, good question. I mean, a lot of unknowns there. But, which also makes me think about another question that we had, that when do we think that we could plausibly say that, either archaeology or historians or whomever can look back and say, okay, we think these people might have been referring to UFOs, extraterrestrials, or advanced technology.
I think that's a common thing nowadays. There's a lot of paintings that were, real famous paintings. Matter of fact, and when you examine them, it looks like what are UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of, it goes back to the Chinese that they have come up with. They had all these pictures of battles in the sky and all the sort of stuff like that. Well, a lot of people say, "Oh, that's just folklore," and but they saw something.
Wasn't that also the fall of the Roman Empire when all the ships came out of the sky? There's an old story. Certainly, I was told that by the indigenous elders.
Oh,
well, that'd be news to me, but would the indigenous know about the Romans?
Yeah, some do.
Interesting.
Yeah.
When you look at some of the technologies from a long time ago, whether they're the Mayans or, like that, they had to get some insight somewhere. I mean, they just didn't wake up some night and say, oh, gee, I think we should map these stars or this, that, and the other. And there are cases of things they have found that, like 1,000 or 1,500 years ago in some dig that replicate a bird, but a plane.
Right.
And there's all sorts of things that they have found that just contradict what the basic underlying thought process is.
There's no clean narrative.
You have to wonder. I mean, a big one that I kind of have to laugh at is the Sphinx.
Mm.
Well, the Sphinx has a lot of wear on it, but it's not from wind and sand, because that would be, horizontal type lines. These are vertical, up and down, and the only thing that can cause that is water.
Interesting.
That's interesting.
And when was there water, enough water like that to cause that kind of erosion? About 10, 12,000 years ago.
I had a feeling. That is very interesting. Very interesting.
Here's another little tidbit. If you take the perimeter of the pyramid and divide it by the height, you get pi.
Really?
It's perfect.
I had not heard that before. That is very interesting.
There are so many mathematical type things about the pyramids that are just, you just have to wonder, how in the hell they do that?
Don't you think, though, that a lot of our viewing of history, certainly what we were taught in school when we were young, is skewed by a religious viewpoint?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I would say especially probably back in the day, in the, 60s, 70s. Mm. Probably less so, but I would tell you this. The history that you learn in primary school or elementary school or whatever you want to call it, vastly different than what you learn in, the collegiate level. Because once you get to a certain point, everybody says, yeah, we really don't know, but based on this and this, we think it's this. And it constantly changes, has competing ideas. It is a living thing. That's what I love about history.
History is told by the winners.
Yeah.
True enough.
So,
I mean,
it's kind of one of those things where, even when you start talking about the history of the Civil War, I mean, the way it really was and what you learn in school are, really different.
Well, there's always so much in complexity too, but even if the winners aren't around anymore, then we still have that lens because what we know about the Celts, what we know about many of these different tribes, they were not literate. They didn't have writing that they can pass down to us except for maybe Druidic runes. So we rely on the Romans and the Greeks and things like that, but it is very fascinating. But, we are coming to the end of our evening. And as we wrap up, I just want to give you an opportunity, Dr. Mike, do you have any last thoughts you want to leave us with?
Not really. I mean, it's kind of one of those things where, just try to be the best person you can. And use some common sense. I know common sense is something that
short supply.
You can't fix stupid, but you could use duct tape.
That's funny. I call it universal sense. Whatever makes universal sense.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to kind of go about things and realize that most of the stuff you hear on the media, man, you need to look a little deeper because most of it is just conjecture.
Yeah.
And it's from both sides. I'm not going to say one is better than the other. I'm just saying they want to portray something in their favor, whether it's right or wrong. And you need to really take some time and try to get to the bottom of whatever it is they're spouting.
Right.
I was just talking with a friend of mine about that the other day. I said, I can't watch all the talking heads and all their opinions. No. Just give me the facts. What was the event? What happened? That's all.
Right.
Well, and the problem is that the news media in general take things completely out of context.
Yeah.
And the majority of the people really don't know. So they hear something, they go, wow, that's got to be true.
Yeah.
Well, and you're exactly right, because it is a both sides issue. We have narratives, and we look for things to support that narrative, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
I will tell you, if I read something online, I immediately don't believe it until I can see the source, who said it, where did it come from, because there's so much misinformation all over the place. Yeah. Everybody wants to justify their worldview.
I don't listen to the news anymore.
Yeah, well, and there's certain things you can do to, just get the, the direct feeds. But I agree with you. I've always hated 24/7 news. I just don't like it. I don't like televised news. I want to be able to read the source. I want to be able to get to the bottom of it. And like Teresa said, it is a commodity. And that is true for social media influencers as well. They have a financial incentive. So keep a good head on your shoulders.
I might tell y'all, Canadian news is very different than American news.
Oh, yeah, don't you know?
It's very different. For the most part. I just have to throw that in there.
It's like NPR. NPR is, you know.
Yeah.
I think it gets a bad rap sometimes, but I've listened to NPR. They don't really opinionate much, but.
You know, I think Dr. Mike has got a really good point, though, to end on this show. Just try to be as good as you know how to be. Continue to be a good human being and think your way through life, not just emotionally. You know,
mm-hmm. get Watch out involved. For the oceans.
Yeah.
Good advice, too.
You know, Dr. Mike, it's always such a pleasure having you on. It truly is. And I wish you really all the best. In Waco, Texas, for your event. Mm-hmm. That'll be a fun outing for you. And
yeah.
Well, if they don't throw me out, so.
Oh, I don't see that happening. But, you know, I love when you come on because I wouldn't even care if we're broadcasting or if we have other listeners, which I think it's great. I think more people need to hear it. But I just love having these conversations. We can just talk about all these different interesting things, and you have such a wide range of knowledge, and I love it. So appreciate you very much. I know you weren't feeling good last week. Glad you're feeling better.
Yeah, thanks.
Glad you were able to come on with us tonight. Really appreciate it.
And look forward to next week.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, and next week we have Dr. Doug Kelly joining us, Artificial Intelligence and Academic Integrity. Looking forward to that. And, yeah, we're wrapping up here. So, you know, Dr. Mike, appreciate your last thoughts. Dr. Mickey, any last thoughts you want to give us?
Next time I expect a raise.
Yeah.
You got it. I'm sending the contract over for your lawyer's book over.
Anyway, it was my pleasure being here. I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Dr. Vicky?
No, I'm leaving it right where Dr. Mike left off. Just be as good a human being as you can.
You can't beat that. And I'm not going to try either. I'm right there with you. So I just want to say thank you again, Dr. Mike. Thank you, everybody in the chat. Love your contributions tonight. And looking forward to having you join us next week. And until then, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.